the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding is now in session.
Please be seated. All right, we have the first case is in the matter of the petition of Luff Exploration. Okay. All right, for the appellant, Linda Golden, we have Mr. Scott Summer, and is an attorney from Rapid City. And then for Appley Luff Exploration Company, we have Mr. Brett Kennecke, an attorney from Pierre, and Mr. John Morrison, an attorney from Bismarck, North Dakota, and Mr. Richard Williams, an attorney from Pierre, South Dakota. I understand this morning that Mr. Morrison, you'll be going first and speaking for 13 minutes, and then Mr. Williams, you'll speak for 7 minutes. Very well. With that, we will proceed shortly. Being no squawking, we will proceed. Mr. Summer, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Please, the court, counsel, are you ready, ma'am?
Okay.
I represent Linda Golden. Linda Golden is a landowner and mineral owner of certain real estate in Harding County, South Dakota. This case involves a dispute over compulsory pooling and how the South Dakota compulsory pooling statutes ought to be applied. It is our position on behalf of Mrs. Golden, quite simply, that the statute should be applied as written, and that the Board of Minerals and Environment did not accomplish that end in the manner that they proceeded. Critically, the Board of Minerals and Environment has set forth certain administrative rules that it feels have superseded the language of the South Dakota statutes on compulsory pooling, and our argument is that the administrative rules cannot supersede the requirements of statute, but must are subservient to the statutes, and the statute should be enforced as written. Compulsory pooling is one very important component of a general body of law referred to as oil and gas conservation law. In the context of this particular dispute, the two components of oil and gas conservation law that are involved are spacing of oil and gas wells and then the pooling of ownership interests of the various mineral owners within a given oil and gas spacing unit. There are other provisions of oil and gas conservation law, but those are the two that are before us today. And what we have in this case is a telescoping, if you will, down of a sequence of events to where we're playing the Luff was playing a constant game of leapfrog and trying to hurry up in a way that was expedient for their own business purposes but did not conform to the law and the requirements of the law for compulsory pooling in South Dakota.
They did not have to wait. They could drill before before they got their pulling order. I mean, that wasn't a violation of the law, was it?
You know, I think our laws could be more clear on this subject, Your Honor, but the South Dakota statutes that deal with compulsory pooling do provide specifically at 45.935 that the compulsory pooling order shall determine who's entitled to drill and operate the well. And if the board has authority pursuant to that statute to determine who shall have the authority to drill and operate the well, my reading of that statute, and I suggest yours should be that until that compulsory pulling order is entered, nobody has the authority to drill a well on a spacing unit that has been established.
But Section 36 clearly contemplates a subsequent pulling order.
And I think there's a bit of an unfortunate circumstance in the area of oil and gas law where the term pooling has come to have several indistinct, potentially ambiguous meanings. And what the, and given the history of the case law in matters such as this and the terminology is used, it's my suggestion that this court should see that 45936, excuse me, that talks about the drilling of a well before pooling should be read in the context of spacing. Because that's really where the dispute has been historically in the law on disputes such as this, is does the court, if a well is drilled before a spacing unit is entered, established, does the court have authority to retroactively apply the allocation of costs and production when a spacing order is entered after the well has been drilled? And I think in the context of these statutes overall, as read together, 45936 should be read as having that meaning, that this court doesn't have jurisdiction to allocate production prior to a spacing order, except to the extent you're allocating costs from the pooling of that well. So, I don't know, the terminology is unfortunate. It's, pooling is, in some contexts seems to mean spacing. Pooling in some contexts seems to mean compulsory pooling. And quite honestly, pooling in some contexts appears to also mean unitization, which is yet another different subject in our statutes. So I think you could you can get hung up on that particular term in that context.
All right, Mr. Sumner, going back for a minute, you state the general or the specific provision you want to talk about today is whether or not the statute should be specifically applied or whether the administrative rules change it. What specifically are you talking about? You got off on another tangent. What are you saying wasn't done?
Okay. In this circumstance, where Linda Golden petitioned to intervene in a contested case proceeding on an oil compulsory pooling proceeding, it's our position, the way the statutes read, that in that circumstance, the Board of Minerals and Environment was required to issue a compulsory pooling order that conformed to the statutes.
All right. What are you saying wasn't done?
Okay. And specifically, the compulsory pooling order that was issued in this case did not afford Linda Golden an opportunity to elect to participate in the operation of the well under the terms of that pooling order. That's very critical.
Had she refused? It seemed like she'd refused to lease or participate prior to that, had she not?
I think it's very important for this court, in analyzing issues in this case, to distinguish leasing from participating. Because I think, in fairness to Luff, Luff did make a good faith attempt prior to drilling this well to lease Mrs. Golden's mineral interests. We don't dispute that they made a good faith attempt to lease her mineral interests. But we assert that they did not make a good faith attempt to negotiate with her once she decided not to lease, that they did not make a good faith attempt to negotiate with her to participate in this well.
So how far do you want this case sent back if you prevail? Do you want it to go back to the hearing before the board, or do you want it to go back and have another negotiating session? Where do you want us to go with this case?
Well, I guess I would say that under the evidence that is what that has been presented, this court should find and determine that there is no evidence upon which to predicate an award of risk compensation to Luff in this case, and Luff did not negotiate with Mrs. Golden in good faith in advance of seeking the compulsory pooling order, and that as a result, we should have a compulsory pooling order in this case that does not include a provision for risk compensation in it.
So you're saying the time for negotiations done?
Well, you know, as lawyers, we negotiate matters in at any stage in the proceedings based upon the risks with which we are presented. I'm not sure exactly what it is you're hoping to have me say, Your Honor.
I'm hoping you answer my question.
Well,
I mean,
I'd like a ruling from this court in my client's favor.
You're complaining that your client didn't get in a good faith negotiation process. Are you asking for that, or are you asking to be remanded to the board for another hearing, or what are you asking for?
I'm asking that you reverse the decision of the Board of Minerals and Environment based on the present record, because the evidence is not there to justify the issuance of the order that they issued. There's no proof of a good faith negotiation with Mrs. Golden to have her participate in the well before proceeding with compulsory pooling. That's by regulation a condition precedent to the issuance of a compulsory pooling order that has a risk compensation penalty in it. Luff didn't engage in that good faith negotiation. By application of the rule, they're not entitled to risk compensation in a compulsory pooling order. Moving forward to the hearing itself, Luff did not present meaningful evidence on the issue of risk compensation to the board. Luff took a chance. Luff's they're an oil company. They weren't born yesterday. They went into this hearing and took a chance that they would not be held to account for their lack of evidence.
All right.
On the issue of risk.
There was evidence, was there not, that the risk factor was between 400 and 500%, and this one was actually 100%, so it was actually much lower than was presently being offered in the area.
The person who provided that testimony was an oil and gas landman. A landman is somebody who negotiates.
But there was, that goes to weight, not to the fact that there wasn't evidence. There was evidence.
Well, I'll suggest, Your Honor, that there was not evidence of the actual risk associated with this well in this location under these circumstances using these drilling methods to drill this well at this time. There was no evidence, period, none. We had a person who is not an expert, not a technical person.
Okay, did you present any evidence?
We presented, through cross-examination of Mr. Chessman, the actual history of the well drilling success that Luff has had with drilling horizontal wells into the B zone of the Red River Formation. And from that testimony, from the actual well records, insofar as we were allowed to go, because there were objections and we were cut off in our presentation of this evidence through cross-examination, we established a nearly 100% success rate on the drilling of wells of this type in this formation, in this vicinity, by Luff in recent years. So yes, we feel we did, through the actual well records and Luff's actual drilling history, present evidence to establish that a 100% risk compensation penalty was not reasonable. 100% risk compensation gives Luff double their money. If Mrs. Golden's proportionate share of the expenses of drilling, completing, and equipping this well is $260,000, with a 100% risk compensation penalty, they get those costs and then 100% more, another $260,000. We feel that before they're entitled to take, and before they're entitled to have the board and the courts on appeal require the Mrs. Golden fork over $260,000 to them, that they present some actual evidence of risk that all bears right. upon this particular well.
What would happen if it was a dry well or if there was water in it?
Okay, if the party drilling the well takes the risk.
So they'd get nothing. So that's a definition of risk compensation.
Okay, but Mrs. Golden is required under the this court is required, the board was required under the statute to give Mrs. Golden an opportunity to elect whether to participate in this well under the terms of a compulsory pooling order. She was never given that opportunity.
So that's what you're arguing about.
Okay, and to a certain extent...
I'm just asking. I'm not arguing with you. I'm trying to define what your position is. Your position is she wasn't given the opportunity to make that election.
Under the terms of the order. Correct. And that Luff jumped the gun. And they're trying then to take their misdeed, so to speak, of drilling the well before there's a compulsory pooling order and somehow hold Mrs. Golden accountable for their election to proceed in that manner. If they didn't want to undertake a risk by drilling a well before getting a compulsory pooling order, then they shouldn't have done it. And they shouldn't hold Mrs. Golden responsible for not electing to participate in a well under the terms of compulsory pooling order that has not yet been issued. You either get the cart before the horse. We're playing leapfrog here. And we're trying to confuse concepts and principles, I think. Luff is doing it. And the board, and quite honestly, has done it. You know, I think the way this regulation should be construed is that the 100% risk compensation penalty for an unleased mineral owner provided for in the regulation should be the presumption if somebody like Mrs. Golden, an unleased mineral owner, is presented with a compulsory pooling order and she elects not to contest the proceeding. What that does is eliminate an unnecessary hearing for having Luff, in an uncontested case, present proof to the board to get an order from the board as to what the risk compensation should be. But in a circumstance where you have a contested case, then Mrs. Golden, as an unleased mineral owner, is entitled to due process, both procedural and substantive due process hearing on what the terms of that compulsory pooling order should be.
And what type of criterion would you have envisioned? You don't contest who will drill the well or who will operate the well. And so what type of additional criterion would you be looking for in that order? Would it simply be the compulsory risk-sharing contribution? Or are you looking for other criteria, the time and manner in which the owners may elect to participate? How would you see that order being fleshed out?
You know, in the usual case, risk compensation is the critical issue that needs to be determined. And the terms of that risk compensation need to be shown, established by the board through the contested case process and presented to Mrs. Golden, and then she should be given a reasonable time within which to make her election under the terms of that order. But in this case, where Luff drilled the well first, we have found the case authority from the Michigan Traverse Oil case to suggest that in that circumstance, imposition of a risk compensation, I'll call it a penalty, risk compensation penalty is not appropriate because they drilled the well before they got a compulsory pooling order. They present no authority to the contrary. And given the fact that our statutes and orderly development of the pool requires that the state control the circumstances under which wells are drilled, should require that. And in this particular circumstance, we have a dispute between an oil company and an unleased mineral owner. But it is equally possible in a circumstance to have a dispute between two oil companies over compulsory pooling, where they can't agree on who is going to be the operator. So Luff would have this court think that our oil and gas conservation laws should be a race to the courthouse, so to speak. Whoever gets their permit request to the board into the department first should get the opportunity to drill the well, even though somebody else showed up an hour later and wanted a permit to drill that well. Who's to decide who gets the right to drill that well in that circumstance? And it's the Board of Minerals and Environment, and it's the compulsory pooling statutes that determine where you have that conflict of interest, who's going to be afforded the right to drill that well. So the fact that we only have one oil company in this fight shouldn't change how you should implement the statutes. The statutes should still require a compulsory pooling order to be in place to determine who the operator of the well is. And if they're going to jump the gun and drill the well first, the consequence to them should be, in this circumstance, that they should not be entitled to recover risk compensation, and that's what the case law that we presented suggests.
So you're seeking a remand back to the board for an order giving her the right to elect within X number of days, and then a determination as to what level of risk compensation she would be responsible for. At this point, it's 100%. Your view would be zero.
Well, you know, we can speak a lot in a lot of different hypothetical situations if we want, but in this particular circumstance, the evidence is already there. I'm asking that in this particular set of circumstances, that the compulsory pooling order not have a risk compensation provision. And as in the alternative, if there is going to be a risk compensation provision, then Mrs. Golden should be told what it's going to be based on the evidence and given a reasonable time within which to decide whether to participate. But I'm also telling you that there is no evidence in this record upon which to predicate the award of a risk compensation provision to Luff. They took the chance that they wouldn't be held to account for their lack of evidence. And in taking that chance, they should be held accountable for the fact that they didn't present meaningful evidence to this to the board upon which to establish risk compensation. At the outset, Mr. Morrison said they were basically here before the board that day to determine whether Luff was able to establish that they had made a good faith attempt to negotiate with Mrs. Golden, and if so, then the impose a risk compensation provided for by the regulation, case closed, go home. In effect, Mrs. Golden has no opportunity for a meaningful hearing on the merits of the issues presented in a contested case proceeding for the compulsory pooling of her oil and gas interests. And the state, through this order, took $260,000 of her money without due process of law and gave it to Luff Exploration Company. I think my time is up.
I think it is. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Morrison, you have 13 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. First, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today, Brock H.A. It's an honor to be here. This argument of Mrs. Golden's, basically there are two aspects of the argument. First is a purely legal issue, and that is the validity of the provisions in 72.12.10 of the Administrative Rules of South Dakota. And it's a head-on challenge to the validity of the rules. The second is the factual issue. Was there a good faith effort to negotiate, and is the 100% reasonable? We don't think there are serious questions presented on either of these. On the legal issue, it's a simple analysis. It's clear the board has the express authority to promulgate rules and regulations to administer its duties under the statutes.
But only within the grant of that authority.
Yes.
They can't exceed it, and that's what I hear him saying they did.
Well, and I'll get to that. I mean, I don't think they have exceeded it, but there are certain procedures you have to get to that challenge in the first place. I mean, the administrative agency has the discretion first to act by generally applicable rule or on a case-by-case basis in contested cases. And these rules were promulgated in 2004, 10 years ago. The rules have the force and effect of law, and that's well established in South Dakota. Statutes also provide that if you want to challenge a rule, the way to challenge a rule is to bring a declaratory judgment action in the county of the plaintiff's residence. And in 1980, this court in Homestake Mining versus Board of Environmental Protection said that the correct procedure for bringing before the court the question of the validity of a rule is that specified in 126.14. In other words, if you don't like the rule, you challenge the rule in a declaratory judgment action. You don't collaterally challenge a rule in an appeal from an adverse determination in a contested case proceeding.
Well, in Paul Nelson's appeal about a year ago, we did exactly what you say we can't do. We ruled that the Department of Revenue's rule exceeded the statute, and it was a question of whether the tax was due or not. It was
Okay. And let's get then to the merits of the rule. Okay, what the rule does is set out a procedure for conducting the process of obtaining the elections and for establishing the penalty that will apply. It tells companies like Luff who want to drill wells, companies like or entities and persons like Mrs. Golden who own minerals, how they can administer those rights. We don't think there is a conflict
between the provisions in 72.12.10 and the provisions of chapter. 45.9.31 says a pooling order shall be upon terms that are just and reasonable. The board has rulemaking authority, and what it's done is told interested parties what terms it will consider in the general case to be just and reasonable. 45.9.32 says a pooling order shall prescribe the time and manner in which owners may elect to participate. And what the rule does is say, as a general policy, we are adopting these provisions that will govern all people coming before us and saying, you make a reasonable effort, you offer participation, you offer a lease, and then you have the opportunity to participate. If you don't participate, the penalty applies.
So that's not what the statute says. I mean, the statute trumps, statutes trump rules.
If there is a conflict.
Right.
Yes.
And this statute says that a pooling order shall prescribe the time and manner in which an owner can elect to participate. Now, this pooling order doesn't have that.
And that's because following the rules that have been adopted, that election had already been made, and what the board did was confirm in the order that the opportunity had been afforded, the election had been made. So there was no need to, in the rule or in the order, go out and again allow an additional time to participate.
But that's not what the statute says. It says the order shall prescribe the time. Doesn't this mean that in a case like yours, where the driller decides to take the risk and drill before they get the pooling order, that they're assuming some additional risk here by allowing owners the chance to take a look after the fact, that they're going to know whether the well mechanically made it or not and get a chance to make an election? Isn't that what the whole case really comes down to?
To some extent, but I think you do have to consider the rule that has been in force in effect for 10 years, which is the way the board has said we're going to implement and administer our provisions of the chapter. And I think it can be read consistently with 45.9.33 in that the rule expands upon the statute, not conflicting with the statute, but detailing the procedures by which you comply with the statutory requirement by giving the notice in advance. And it's a way the board chose to get its duties done in a reasonable time frame and not have to deal with contested cases on every issue that really presents the same issue to the board. Well,
where are you saying that Mrs. Golden had the opportunity to make an election? Was that on the lease, or was that a separate election on the participation?
On July 17, 2013, and this was in Exhibit 3 that was presented to the board, Luff sent the offer to participate, or the election to participate, to Mrs. Golden. It included a lease, but also included an AFE, or authority for expenditure, which set forth the estimated amounts the well was going to cost, what her interest would be, and said, be advised that if you decide not to grant Luff a lease or elect not to participate in the cost and risk of the above drilling operation, Luff intends to request the board for a penalty. So, in other words, in that letter, which was Exhibit 3 before the board, that opportunity was given.
Was there a communication to her at any point to make an election knowing what the penalty would be?
What the letter said was that we would seek risk compensation pursuant to South Dakota Administrative Rule 74-12-10. So express reference was made to the administrative rules that set out the penalty. And it's also clear in the record that there had been a prior well in which Ms. Golden also had minerals, didn't participate, and had reached an agreement to be carried subject to the penalty. So in this case, Mrs. Golden had actual knowledge of the penalty. When she responded that after consultation with her attorney, she elected not to participate, or she elected to be force pooled in the well. So it was clear that the rule existed. Mrs. Golden had legal representation. Mrs. Golden had prior knowledge of the rule and what the penalty was. So clearly she did have knowledge of what the 100% penalty was.
under your view, what role would the Board of Minerals play in this? We have someone who's elected not to participate. You appear before the Board. She, at that point, has hired a lawyer and is contesting and is wanting the Board to set the terms for operation.
Well, I mean, first of all, the role in a contested case would be, has a reasonable offer been made? In other words, did she have a reasonable opportunity to elect a lease, meaning was she offered reasonable lease terms, or to participate in the well? Was she given the information she needed to make an informed election and participate?
And that wasn't contested here, nor was who should operate or drill the well, but rather just risk compensation.
And again, the Board interprets a 100% risk compensation in the rule as really a presumption. And I was kind of curious to hear Mr. Sumner earlier today saying that the 100% is a presumption. Well, if it is a presumption, then the presumption can be rebutted. And so Ms. Golden could have come to the hearing and presented evidence that the penalty should be something other than 100%. And there was absolutely no evidence presented in the record to support anything other than 100%. And Mr. Sumner claims that the Board relied solely on the rule and Luff didn't do his job, but that's really not what the record reflects. The record reflects that there was testimony from Mr. Chessman, who was a landman with 37 years of experience, who was also a participant in the well. He wasn't just a landman hired by the company. He was a working interest owner participating in the risk and cost of drilling the well. He said 100% is reasonable. He said 400% to 600% is standard in the industry. This court has prior experience in application of Coleman, a 1979 case, where the court affirmed an earlier Board decision saying that 100% penalty was reasonable. Chessman also testified that there were real risks in drilling this well. The fact that you have a history of success in the Red River B doesn't mean there aren't drilling risks, there aren't completion risks, there aren't economic risks. Clearly economic conditions are much different today at $30 net oil prices than they were in 2013 at, $80 or $90 oil prices. Those are all risks that the operator should be compensated for. Now, Ms. Golden could have come in and said no, presented expert testimony from a lineman or a geologist or an engineer, or even testified herself and done something to establish that the penalty should be something other than 100%, but she didn't. So those are both issues that could have been explored and developed at the hearing.
Well, Mr. Sumner said he did cross-examine, and that certainly is evidence in whatever questions or answers he got.
But the answers you got were that, yes, we have a high rate of success in the Red River, but there still are risks in drilling any well.
But it isn't going by default because there was no evidence if he did cross-examine and got some testimony that he thinks is in his favor.
But there's no evidence that even he can point to say, well, instead of 100%, the risk should have been, the penalty should have been 50% or 75% or 0%. There's simply a lack of that evidence in the record. Before my time is up, the issue of you have to pool before you drill the well, and that clearly is not consistent with the statutes in South Dakota. The only case that exists to support that is the Michigan case, as cited by Mr. Sumner. And if you read that Michigan case, it clearly relies on a rule that says after a petition for compulsory pooling has been granted, a party who has been forced pooled is entitled to elect which of two methods he wishes to use. So the rule in that case specifically says after a petition for compulsory pooling has been granted, a party has a right to make that election. So there is a significant difference between the regulations and statutes, which should be interpreted together in this case, and the applicable regulations in the Michigan case. And I have a minute left, but I think I'm going to end my argument at that point and let Mr. Williams take over and present the state's argument.
All right. No one's ever chastised for quitting early in this court.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams, you have 7 minutes, sir.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Richard Williams. I'm an assistant attorney general from the Office of Attorney General, and I'm here today representing the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, which I'll refer to as the department. We would ask the court to affirm the board's decision and therefore also affirm the decision of the Honorable Mark Barnett below. That said, I would like to jump right into the question that Justice Sinner posed earlier, and that is, how do we harmonize the administrative rule, which is 74-12-10-01, with the statute that seems to require that all of these orders have an additional election period in them? And I would suggest to the court that if we look at that statute, if we look at 45-9-32, it says, shall prescribe the time and manner in which all of the owners in the spacing unit may elect to participate in that well drilling. Now, what that says to me is, if one of the tenets of statutory construction is that we have to harmonize the statutes, if possible, with the rules. So we look at that and we say, well, can that possibly mean what it says, all of the owners in the spacing unit? Obviously not, because some of the owners in the spacing unit, we already know, have engaged in voluntary pooling. They're obviously not going to get a second chance after the order is entered to make another election. So that can't mean all of the owners in the spacing unit. There has to be some limitation on that. So you read the statute again, and so it says, shall prescribe the time and manner for those who may elect to participate. I would suggest to you that shall is for applies to those who may elect to participate. So we have to determine who may elect to participate. Well, those who have not otherwise made an election. For instance, those who have done voluntary pooling may no longer participate. Those who have made an election pursuant to rule may no longer participate. So the rule doesn't apply to them any longer. What applies to them is the statute. And that statute, or I'm sorry, the statute no longer applies to them, the rule applies to them. And it causes that election to be made prior to this statute imposing the shall upon them.
But the statute doesn't differentiate between electing and non-electing owners. The statute says all owners in the spacing unit.
And that is true, but what we know is if all owners actually meant all owners in the spacing unit, it would then, again, include those owners who have chosen to voluntarily pool prior to the hearing. And we know that they're not included. Those who have voluntarily pooled cannot elect to participate in the drilling of the well. They may have chosen a lease prior to this, or they may have elected to participate, but they're not, again, given the chance to elect to participate once they've chosen another means.
That would only be because, by contract, they've either leased or elected to participate. So they're contractually, they may be barred, but it seems to me that when it says all owners, that means everybody.
It would, except for what you're describing is a situation where there's been an election, and they've elected by contract to opt out. What's happened in this case is the rule has opted them out.
But she wasn't opted out. She didn't contract.
She was opted out by operation of the rule, we would suggest. And that rule said, if these certain things happen, you have elected to opt out, as if somebody would if they were entering in a contractual agreement.
What language in the rule says that?
We're looking at...
Tell me that language.
74-12-10-01. And this
way?
Only applies...
Go ahead.
It only applies to an owner who elects not to participate in the risk and cost of drilling or operation of the well. And that dovetails back to 32. If you elected not to participate, that's when the rule applies. And the rule only applies to those who have elected to participate, or the statute only applies to those who have elected to participate. So when you put those two together, if you've elected not to participate, that shall no longer applies to you, as it would to those who have contracted for voluntary pooling. It no longer applies to them, even though the statute says all owners. We know that there are people who can opt out of that, and that's what happened in this case. You can opt out by a contractual relationship, or you can opt out by force of rule. And in this case, the rule was followed. You've heard evidence that there was an offer to Ms. Golden to execute a lease or participate in the risk of cost in drilling. That was done. That notice also included that if she chose not to do that, she would then be subject to risk compensation. The next part is evidentiary. The court or the board heard evidence that she did in fact choose not to participate, and in fact, at Administrative Rule page 468, finding 6, the board specifically found that Golden chose not to lease or participate. So that was a factual finding. When we get to the factual findings, we're talking about review on a clearly erroneous standard. So we'd have to say if the board found that she chose to participate, to overrule that, this board, the Supreme Court would have to say the board was clearly erroneous. Then we go down to if when Golden came to the contested case hearing, she could challenge whether that offer was made in good faith, and she could challenge the risk compensation, and she did both. The board again made factual findings on both of those issues. The board took evidence and said, you know what? We believe this was a good faith attempt. And we also believe that there was evidence of the implication of the 100% risk penalty. And it didn't, in this case, simply just use the presumption by rule. It actually took evidence, and Chairman Morris, when he was asked about that, he described it at the hearing. He said, on page 429 to 430, he said, because we took testimony on this, I'm not even giving presumption. I'm basing my decision on the testimony that was in front of this board. So therefore, that was another factual finding. So the board followed the rule and made factual findings on each of these that were supported by evidence, and the only witness in this case was that of Luff, of Mr. Chessman. With that, Your Honors, I'm finished unless there's other questions.
I have one question. If we rule that Shell give notice to all owners means that, and that trumps the regulation, is there a problem with that construction in the industry? What's going to happen?
There is, Your Honor, because I think that includes then those who have voluntarily pooled. And there's going to be a problem with then the right to contract and potentially a taking. For instance, if their contract gave them a better condition than was later given by the board, I think they could say, well, you took from me the contract that I had, and you can't do that. I think we'd run into a constitutional takings problem.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Time has expired. Mr. Sumner, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Having heard Mr. Williams' arguments verbalized, I'm no more enlightened than I was when I read his brief. Because he chases his tail around in circles on how you construe statutes and regulations together. The statute very clearly says, this is 45.932, each such pooling order shall authorize the drilling, equipping, and operation of a well on a spacing unit. The pooling order shall provide who may drill and operate the well. The pooling order shall prescribe the time and manner in which all of the owners in the spacing unit may elect to participate in the well drilling, equipping, and operation, and shall provide for the payment of the reasonable actual costs.
All right. How does that comport with someone who has previously contracted?
Okay, a compulsory pooling order, you're not subject to compulsory pooling order if you have already signed a voluntary pooling agreement. You're not a defendant, so to speak, in the compulsory pooling proceedings. Your interest is contractually committed to the well pursuant to the voluntary pooling agreement.
So the all that you're referring to does not refer to those people?
Correct. It only refers to the people who are going to be, whose interests are being compulsorily pooled, the people whose ownership interests are the target of the compulsory pooling order.
All right. How is that different from what Mr. Williams just stated?
Mr. Williams seemed to think that the compulsory pooling order trumps a voluntary pooling agreement, and I don't think, I surely don't argue that. If you voluntarily pooled, then you're part of the well. I mean, that's one of the options is voluntary pooling. But a compulsory pooling order is only acts upon the people who have not signed a voluntary pooling agreement. And in this case, that's only Linda Golden. And so if somebody like Linda Golden comes into your office as a lawyer and says, well, what are my rights here? I go look at the statute that says, well, you're entitled to participate in the contested case hearing. You look at 45.974 that talks about the notice and hearing process, and you're entitled to a due process hearing on the merits of the issues presented by statute. And by statute, looking to 45.932, that order from the board is required to provide all of these things. You know, who shall authorize the drilling of the well, provide who will be authorized to drill and operate the well and so forth. It includes, you know, from the prior, all of a sudden the name slips me, the prior compulsory pooling decision we have in South Dakota, that that can include a risk compensation. And all we're asking this board, this court to do, is to issue a ruling. The case came to me now, it's Coleman, Enric Coleman, that the board in this case should be required to have issued an order like it issued in the Coleman case. The statutes are fundamentally unchanged since Coleman. The only thing that's different are these regulations. And Mr. Williams and Luff would have you think that the regulations somehow trump the statutes, that the regulations somehow supersede the statutes. And that cannot be. You know, yes, you have to construe all of the statutes together, but I think the rules of construction require that regulations be construed as being subject to the statutes. You cannot exceed your authority to regulate to vary what the statutes provide. And I don't want to get too far afield here, but what has happened in South Dakota is that the Board of Minerals and Environment has attempted to legislate a change for how compulsory pooling is handled in South Dakota to comport with changes that have been made legislatively in North Dakota. If you look at our regulations and their statutes, there's a striking correspondence. But in North Dakota, it was done by legislation. The statutes themselves were amended, and you cannot amend a statute by regulation. And so then I'm left with, well, how do we, should we throw this regulation out altogether? And my response, after thinking about it as carefully as I could, is no, we should construe that statute in the context of, construe the regulation in the context of the statute, which means, to me, in an uncontested case where somebody like Luff goes to Linda Golden, makes her a good faith offer to lease, and in addition, makes her a good faith offer to participate. And if she, in light of that good faith offer, then elects, and then they have to file a petition with the board. I mean, that under the rules, that's still required. You still have to get an order from the board, right? Or the department in an uncontested case proceeding. Still have to get a compulsory pooling order. Then if they proceed with their compulsory pooling order and you do not intervene, then you're subject to those regulations. And that gives certainty and predictability and saves unnecessary hearings. But it doesn't deprive Linda Golden of the right to participate in a contested case proceeding. And it does not absolve Luff of the obligation as the moving party. It is their petition in this case, not Linda Golden's. They're the ones who are seeking compulsory pooling in this case, not Linda Golden. And the regulation does not lift from Luff the burden of proof to establish those things necessary to effectuate a valid compulsory pooling order.
All right. Just so I understand exactly where you're at, are you contesting the good faith offer of a lease? I'm going to go through. Are you contesting the good faith offer of a lease, of a pooling agreement, and you are just contesting the risk factors? Is that what I understand your position?
We do not contest that they made a good faith offer to lease. And contrary to what Mr. Morrison said, Linda Golden's response to that good faith offer to lease was to say that she elected to remain in her unleased status. She did not elect to be forced pooled. That is a different matter. She simply elected to remain unleased. So she is an unleased mineral owner with property rights in this unit. Okay. We do dispute that they made a good faith attempt to negotiate a voluntary pooling agreement with her. Okay. If you would just contrast their presentation of a lease to Mrs. Golden with what they presented to her for participation, you'll see that when they offered her a lease, they actually gave her a lease to look at. Here's the terms of this lease in all its glory, in its details, page after page, specifics. You know, here's what the bonus is, this is what the monthly rental or yearly rental is going to be, this is what the royalty would be, and so forth. You know, I mean, all the terms of the agreement are laid out in essentially a pre-printed form that has been modified to the circumstances. When it comes to participation in the well, they give her a bill. They said, your bill is $260-some-odd thousand. But they didn't offer her the terms of an agreement. They didn't provide her with a joint operating agreement or anything else that might be, I think the term that Mr. Williams used is a participation agreement. I think the term that's in the statute is a voluntary pooling agreement. You know, they didn't offer anything. So we feel that that is not a good faith attempt to negotiate with her to participate. If you don't offer somebody the terms of an agreement you're proposing that they enter into, that's not a good faith attempt. And what they did is they paid lip service to it and hoping that you would lump leasing together with participation and ignore the fact that they did not make a good faith attempt to negotiate with her to participate. That's our position. That's your, as far as you've gone, I presume you had other questions.
No, that was, I'm trying to define where we're at.
And then they filed their compulsory pooling petition. And Mrs. Golden intervened. And by intervening, we now have invoked the statutes. By intervening, it is my submission to you that the regulation that they're relying upon no longer applies. Because by intervening in the proceeding, she is now entitled to a bona fide hearing on the merits of the issues presented regarding compulsory pooling, the terms of provision of compulsory pooling, in particular, just what the risk compensation penalty should be. And that risk compensation penalty should be established based on the evidence. And Luff has the burden of proof, as they're the ones seeking the imposition of a risk compensation penalty. And in this case, Luff took a flyer. And they put somebody on here and says, well, there's always some risk, and that's good enough. And it's not good enough. You know, you don't establish what the expenses are, what the actual economic damages are in a case by having somebody say, well, there's always economic damages.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank
Which
you.
Which is what they've done.
Okay. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.